for the transcript, this will be the NTAG new GTLD applicant working group scheduled from 9 a.m. to 11 a.m. local time.
Okay, why don't we go ahead and get started, if we can get the recording started, please. Thank you. This is Tim Switzer. Welcome to the July 17th Durban NTAG meeting. I would encourage any of you that want to come up to the table and sit, please come on up. There's no reason to have to sit in the back. We look forward to a full agenda here today. So why don't we go ahead and just jump in and get started. First thing I'd like to do is kind of a quick look back and thank the three outgoing officers that have served two six-month terms since we came into existence last July 1st. Krista Papik, who was our secretary, clearly the busiest job of the NTAG XCOM, and now with ICANN. We want to thank her. Bill Dozier, who was the vice chair, and Bill also was the person behind our newsletter. And I think in our early days, that was very critical to us in getting our participation where it's been. And then John Nebbett as our chair and our leader, and quite honestly, John even was the person who came up with the idea of having an observer group and the NTAG. So I'd like to acknowledge the three of them and give them a round of applause and thank you for their help. And I'd also like to have each of the new officers introduce themselves. The new officers came into official duty on July 1st, 6-month terms through the end of the year. As you know, the NTAG has accomplished a lot, I think, in our first year of existence, and has become a very, I think, relevant group within the ICANN multi-stakeholder model, and a lot's been accomplished. And we're certainly going into a different phase now where things, will start being able to transition out of being members of the NTAG and becoming a part of the registry stakeholder group. But I think, as you know, I think the next 6 months there are still a lot of issues for us to work through. But with that, let me have each one of the our new officers introduce themselves.
Hi, I'm Sarah Falvey. I'm at Charleston Road Registry / Google Vice Chair. I just hit my 6-year mark with ICANN, which is slightly depressing. I think that's about it.
I'm Liz Sweezy with Fairwinds Partners, and I just am very close to my 6 years with Fairwinds, which is equally depressing. Just kidding. Anyway.
Hi, I'm Josh Zetlin of Dot Construction. I'm the new secretary, and I'm only a 2-year veteran of ICANN.
Thank you. So before we go right into the agenda, just a couple of things. I want to thank, we do have some members of the ICANN staff here today to join us. So I think we're going to find that, a lot of the things on our agenda, there's been ICANN sessions with already, or it was discussed yesterday in the registry stakeholder group. But I do want to make sure that we, have a good time, plenty of time today to kind of talk about these issues. The one thing I know that the new officers here have talked about, that we want to continue kind of the theme set by the previous leadership team, is we really want to encourage and we welcome participation from everybody. I mean, the NTAG is a very geographical and type of applicant diverse group, and everybody's voice is to be heard. And so we don't want the conversations to be dominated by, 3 or 4 folks. We want to hear from all of you. And whether it's your input here today or whether it's leaving here with we may form a working group or whatever to go off and work on something, we really encourage full and active participation. So everybody's welcome. We want to hear from you. We want to hear your thoughts, and we want to hear your input when it comes time to actually working on various issues. So with that, let's go to the agenda. The first item is that just an official kind of housekeeping. Our last meeting was in late May. We did send out, Josh sent out minutes from that meeting. Does anybody have any questions, edits, or additions to those minutes? Then if not, I will assume those minutes are approved, and thank you very much. Josh, why don't you give us an update on the NTAG membership and where we're at right now?
Josh Zetlin, Dot Construction. On last count, we had 99 total applicants represented, and the total number of applications is 979. But in a bit of exciting news, 3 of our members are no longer voting members, Donuts, CORE, and International Domain Registry are now also members of the RYSG as they've signed the registry agreement.
Thanks, Josh. That is exciting news. I mean, you normally don't celebrate your membership going down, but in this case, it's a good thing. We hope to have more of that throughout the rest of the year.
As our numbers dwindle.
All right, moving right along, Treasurer's Report, Liz.
Thanks, Tim. There are no new expenditures to report, and there are no future expenditures to report at this time. Thank you.
Very good and simple report there. Thank you. All right. So next item on the agenda We want to talk about any kind of open issues around the registry agreement and the RAA. As you saw the other day in the opening ceremony, we've had signatures on the registry agreement, and we also had five registrars that have agreed to sign the RAA. So still a couple issues being worked there. So let me ask Jordan to give us a kind of a quick update on where we're at there and what the next steps are.
Thanks, Tim. Jordan Buchanan for the record. So as Tim just mentioned, the board recently approved the standard registry agreement that we had negotiated extensively in Beijing, and in the weeks following, it was subsequently posted for public comment. And then approved with a number of changes that were, I think, largely clarifications and or several improvements that actually, I think, tended to favor the registry operator. So not particularly material in my mind, with the exception of the one important thing to talk about today, and I know this is later in the agenda, is there are now four mandatory public interest commitments included in the registry agreement as well that the board approved and that will be included in all agreements. And it may actually be helpful. So we haven't signed one of the registry agreements. I know currently contracting parties are being asked to sign a supplement to the registry agreement at the time of signature. I think that's posted, but maybe someone like John or one of the other, or Adrian or one of the other people who have signed the agreement could talk to what that supplement speaks to, or Krista.
Sure. Happy to do it. If anyone has any questions about the contracting process or anything, feel free to pull me or Adrian or Core, I guess, if they're willing, aside. But yeah, surprise to us, we said, we're ready to sign our contract. They said, oh, by the way, we have a supplemental agreement that you need to sign. And that supplemental agreement lists six items that are still what they consider open items. And for those six items, they could unilaterally amend the contract. No questions, no reasons, no rationale, just unilateral amendment. And then number seven is based on GAC advice. It's kind of a catch-all for any reason. So it's spec six, the clearinghouse, the PDDRP process, the RRDRP process, URS, spec 11, that's your pick. So anything spec 11 is fair game for a unilateral amendment, and then anything related to the GAC advice. So it's pretty open-ended. It lasts for 6 months, and then it'll sunset. So, yeah.
I just wanted to add to that. I guess it does sound pretty horrible, and we were surprised by it too. The only reason we did sign it is, I guess, the alternative was to wait, and the only difference would be is we'd have visibility as to what we sign. We wouldn't necessarily have any control over what it looked like. So we'd know what we're getting in for. So the difference is, the delta is, we've signed something that's somewhat blind. However, we'd be forced to sign whatever was going to be coming down the pipeline later anyway. So,
and they already have the unilateral right to amend right now. So it didn't really change our position in the contract, but at least we have a contract and can move forward with testing and delegation. So that was our thinking as well.
Good, thanks. Reg?
Just to clarify, is that 6 months from the date that you signed it? So every time you sign a contract for your new next TLD, you've got another 6 month window.
Yeah, that's a great question. I actually had that. If you compare ours to maybe some of the other ones that signed it, we put a date certain in that was 6 months out, and for that reason. So we're going to use that date certain for every one of our contracts going forward.
And you think ICANN will accept that date for your future contracts, even if it's in the past or 2 weeks from then?
Hope so. Yeah, their view, based on conversations with him, was that we don't need the 6 months. We need much less. We're hopefully we'll figure out the open clearinghouse issues. We'll figure out the PIC DRP issues, and then maybe they won't need this rider in contracts that come up in 2 months' time from now.
This is Tim Switzer. Let me just remind everyone to please identify themselves when they talk. Thank you. Go ahead, Krista.
Thanks. Krista Papik, ICANN staff. So I just want to reiterate what Adrian was saying, because that's exactly why we did the supplement, is we could wait until these issues are resolved and then proceed you to contracting, or we could give you an option. So it's it's meant as an option and as a way to allow those registries that are willing to consider the supplement to move forward with contracting.
Go ahead, Adrian.
Adrian Kinderis. And I think it's important, you guys got the benefit now, and I'm happy that ICANN moved so quickly to post the RA, such that you'll see those supplementary documents now, and you'll be able to at least have some visibility if you are in a position to sign. So that's a good thing by ICANN.
Okay, I have Roland and Jeff in the queue. Roland, go ahead.
Yeah, Roland LaPlante affiliates. Does the GAC piece sunset also?
Yeah, the entire supplement sunsets.
Great. Thank you.
I mean, there's still obviously amendment rights that ICANN has in the main agreement. It's just this pure unilateral right to amend in the supplement will go away. And I also should comment to Chris's point that the contractor process went really smoothly. ICANN staff was very responsive, and the process worked very well. So kudos to you guys.
Great. Thank you. Jeff?
Thanks. The supplement, I guess, was just posted yesterday. So it was actually a little bit late to talk about during the contracting the contracting session that was earlier. But I feel bad for the guys that had to sign it just because it's incredibly overreaching. I thought there were a number of elements in there that didn't seem open to me, that seemed like ICANN was keeping open. So the question I have for ICANN is, what is the process for closing those items moving forward such that not every applicant's going to have to sign the supplemental? What are the dependencies in there so that by the time Adrian signs his next one, that or Donut signs their next one, that those items will be considered closed and done? I mean, there were a lot of open things that I just had no clue would stay open, things like the URS and some other items. So if you could please let everyone know, and also this is still pretty much, I don't want to say it's secret because it's not hidden, but it's just not well known. It wasn't publicized at all that there were these additional things that are now left open. So if there's a process for closing those.
I'd just like to thank Jeff for his sympathy. Appreciate it.
Go ahead, Krista.
So Krista Papik, ICANN staff. So we know that these things are open because they're open items in the registry agreement that's posted. They're on all of these except PIC DRP, which we're working on with the negotiating team. We just received a document last night. We're working to move forward. But these things were covered in Christine's update as far as next steps and timelines and things like that. So I also wanted to just to add to that and something I think maybe John was saying or that some of the dialogue, our intention's not for these things to go on forever. Again, we were just trying to provide an opportunity to move forward with contracting for those of you who wanted to do it. So nobody has to sign this. No, you can wait for the things to be resolved, and then once they're resolved, you can go through with your contract. And then finally, just one other thing is those that signed also have a right to terminate the registry agreement with some, I think it's a 30-day notice period. So you're not locked into this thing. If the first item in the supplement comes out with a resolution and you're not happy with it, you can terminate your registry agreement.
Thanks, Krista. Adrian and Jeff in the queue.
Do you want to go? bond's a little different.
Or we have Jeff and Adrian in queue.
Yeah, so I mean, I completely thanks, Krista. I understand why things like Spec 11 is open because we're still talking about the PIC DRP, and I understand why the trademark clearinghouse requirements, because there's things open there. What really surprised me are things like specification 6, registry interoperability and continuity specifications. Open. That doesn't make sense to me. If there was a specific element in there that's still being discussed, although I wasn't aware that anything's still being discussed in the continuity spec, I mean, I thought that was pretty much final. That surprised me. The registration restriction dispute resolution policy, I thought that was pretty much final. The URS, I thought that was pretty much final. And then the last thing that basically says any provision or term of the registry agreement that is subject to advice or comment from the GAC. It's not just comments on what the GAC's talking about now, which I'm not actually sure what they're talking about now that would relate to Adrian or John's agreements, because there are specific Category 1 strings and there are strings that they didn't move forward with the CIR. So there were some surprises in there. While I understand that, you know, things that were everyone considered open should be on there, those things, especially Specification 6, if you could explain that, or maybe in the next agreements that you sign, really narrow that down as to what elements of Specification 6. Because right now it just says, notwithstanding anything else in the registry agreement, to the contrary, registry agrees that the following requirements, procedures, and provisions of the registry agreement may be modified and amended by ICANN after this date without consent. And then it just says Spec 6. That's pretty big. I mean, I'm surprised Adrian signed it. Oh, actually, I'm not surprised he signed it.
I'll sign anything.
But that's not something that any, I could say any brand will sign, certainly, and it's not something that a lot of TLDs will sign. So if you could clarify what specifically in Specification 6, and then in the next supplement, narrow it down.
Krista?
I just want to reiterate, you don't have to sign this. You can wait for all of these issues to be resolved.
What needs to be resolved in Spec 6? I guess that's my question.
I'm going to have to get back to you on that. Did you want me to respond to URS or PDDRP or RRDRP?
Yeah, okay. Sure.
So, Krista, again. So on those ones, URS is almost all the way done. There was a document that you know about that was posted. It's just some final process issues with the PDDRP and the RRDRP. We're in the process of selecting vendors, and then there's going to be the rules, and so all of those things have to be locked down in order to consider them final for the actual contract itself.
I'm just slow this morning, but I don't understand what the contract would have to do with the selection of a vendor or the specific procedures, the supplemental rules, or the rules. And the supplemental rules of each of the providers are not, those rules are not in the actual contract. They're referred to, but they're not in the actual contract. And that's usually the way it's been done in the past has been the agreements can still be signed without actual changes.
So, Jeff, Krista, so you're agreeing to the URS, or let's pick the PDDRP because it's less further down the road. It's not as far down the road. So you're agreeing to the PDDRP, and you're also agreeing to the rules and the process and how that works. Those things aren't locked down yet. So we're locking those down, and we're also, you know, at some point in there, those rules might come out, and you might say, never mind, we don't want to do this at all.
You have the right to terminate your agreement without notice. I mean, sorry, with notice, you have the agreement to terminate. You have the right to terminate.
Okay, thanks.
All right, thank you. Adrian?
Thanks, Adrian Kinderis. Krista, I just wanted to clarify something. I got a little wound up at the contracting session the other day. I think it's important for the NTAG, and that is the view of prioritization with respect, the respect of prioritization throughout the process. And I just wanted to make sure that I understood correctly because I've since spoken to Cyrus and Couples just to get some clarification on something you said, and that is that So maybe it's better to give the example to explain. If ICANN releases through the CIR, requests the CIR at midday in Los Angeles on a Wednesday, okay, that's completely acceptable. And what I understood the process to be is you would then have a batched window whereby you would take, say you sent out one prioritization number 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5 on that Wednesday. The following Tuesday, close of business, you close the window. You received back 3, 4, and 5. 1 and 2 took their time, okay? You would then prioritize those as far as you getting back to them in number 3, 4, then 5, okay? Because they got back to you as far as getting their contract signed. Then the following week, the next day at 12 o'clock on Wednesday, you then sent out 6, 7, 8, 9, and 10. Say they all responded back within that next week, as well as 1 and 2, okay, from the week before. You now have one, so you would now prioritize the way you would respond to those as 1, 2, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. So that you would take, because prioritization still is, so it's not first come, first serve back in. The prioritization number still holds true, and they've just now entered that batch, and they carry the priority in that batch. Am I correct that that is the way it will be going forward?
Krista, ICANN staff. No, you're not correct. The way that we initiate contracting based on priority number and eligibility, so was it 1 through 10? Is that what you said? Okay. So we send out 1 through 10, and then we process them in the order that they come back. The reason that we do that is we would be sitting around for a week waiting for responses to come in, and now we've lost a whole week of time. And we, as has already been discussed, I think, in the contracting session, the responses aren't coming back that quickly. So when I send them out, 1 through 10, I don't send them out, actually. Christine's team sends them out. But when they send them out, they receive them back, and they vet them to make sure that they're complete. Once they're complete, they're actually in our system. We click a button that they're complete, and it date time stamps it, and it moves forward to the next phase based on that. It doesn't make any sense if number 3 comes in for us to sit and wait for 1 and 2 to come in when we could actually be just pushing stuff through the pipe.
Yeah, so in mind, you're not sitting and waiting. You've got a week worth of window. You can still process those within the week. You can't just send them out. Because I'll tell you why. Because I'll tell you my experience of the last week was I wanted to be the first contract signed. I had a priority number 3, but I wasn't guaranteed that I was going to be the first. I knew that the first two weren't going to sign. One's one of my clients, and another one was a closed generic and couldn't sign. So we should have been first no matter what, okay? That's what I understood the prioritization meant. Now, I stayed awake, as did my staff, and checked in US business hours every 3 minutes on our Citrix to see whether anything came in so that we could turn it around as quickly as possible and make sure. So now, if I listen to you, or if it goes forward the way that you're suggesting, at 12 o'clock on a Wednesday, if I'm in business hours in Los Angeles, I can turn mine around immediately. If I'm asleep in Zimbabwe, I can't turn it around, okay, as quickly. That's assumed, unless I'm staying awake and waiting for that batch release. So for mine, and you'll hear me bang this drum many times, I think you're providing advantage for somebody working within the hours. Now, you can move those hours, but then you're providing advantage to somebody else.
So a couple of things. Krista, again, with respect to you wanting to go first, that's a very unique circumstance, right? So that only happened once, and it's already happened. So that's the first thing. The second point is we don't have one person processing these things as they come in. So that time zone thing that might be a challenge, to your point, is not going to – effectively, those people are going to go through at the same time because we've got multiple people handling this. So it's – that 12-hour lag, and it's another reason why we've got the 40 a week. When Christine said in the contracting session on Monday that we also don't want to send a whole ton of them out at one time because it messes up the priority numbers as well. We want to try and respect them. So we're balancing process and efficiency against priority numbers. So, again, in that example, even if those came in 12 hours later, they still would get processed, give or take, the same amount of time. Because we have multiple people working on these things.
Okay, thank you. Anybody else have any questions on the agreement process? Okay. Next under this is Maxim. I think it's sent around the note to the group about some concerns on the COI, and I think you know, through the application phase, there's been some.
Sorry to interrupt, Tim. We have a question on Adobe Connect.
Okay.
From Maxim, the question is: do these CIR people work 24 hours a day?
It feels like it sometimes. Krista, no, we're the people that are processing this stuff are in Los Angeles.
Okay, thank you. So I think there's been some, you know, kind of movement around, I think, the COI requirements. I think there, you know, for the application, and I think maybe what was required for the application versus for the agreement may have been, I know there's been some issues around that, so I'm going to turn it over to Maxim to talk about that, if he can come in via the phone. Maxim?
Hello.
Hello, we can hear you.
Maxim, also for society. Short notice about the CIR and changes to COI. If we read this document, particularly the Article 3 COI, first glance make me think that the document was made by someone new to the process. New GTLD last 3 years, and maybe legal advisor subcontractor. And these changes are like last minute. My reason to think so, when we look through the document, multiple sub-articles seems to have issues. Starting from term, we need to have a letter of credit effective from moment of execution of the RA. It's unknown moment in the future, and we have to guess to make it 6 years from that moment. So now we have to change letters of credit to 7 years. Otherwise, you cannot point the precise moment of 6 years from array execution. Actually, in AJB, it was at least 5 years. Anyway, we go to sabbatical funding, where we do not see the cap on amount of letter of credit of $300,000. We hope this omission wasn't intended. And unreasonable and unpredicted addition of new requirements to the COI after the financial panel evaluation of some of applicants seems strange. Anyway, sabbatical beneficiary. Addition to the text of letter of credit of new legal terms, like dual certificate. I doubt any of us has it in Swift text, which was attached as Q50 answer to our applications. And sabbatical consent itself. It adds demands of inclusion of the icon to the strictly two-sided bank to applicant contract. On letter of credit to ICANN, where ICANN is a beneficiary, but is a third party to that contract. And we actually doubt that banks will agree on this and the next advance notice requirements. In last AJB, it was a requirement to register itself and not to the letter of credit. To not to change letter of credit without consent from ICANN. The same in the last RA, requirement to registry and not to the letter of credit. looking at the letter of credit example, it is a documentary form instead of SWIFT one, which is the only form allowed in some countries, for example, in Europe. And the text of CIR looks like creators of CIR documents decided to forget or completely unaware of all the month of conversations around ICANN's US-based approach to letter of credit and all the efforts applicants made to be maximum compliant with the wishes of ICANN. Using of SWIFT compatible text of example of letter of credit, which could be used by applicants, would be greatly appreciated and will be much more useful than the provided example. Effectively, this current form of CIR suggests that we haven't passed financial panel yet. Actually, some of applicants passed that. It's funny to notice then, as an applicant, we had two identical letters of credit, and one gained one point, and the other got three. Guess what? The one which got three had a big amount of money in it. Okay, just a joke. Outcome. My thinking that we could contact with ICANN because five out of seven sub-articles of this document related to COI in this document have issues. I think that we should suggest ICANN to review this part of document of CIR to make it consistent with the requirements of AJB and the process made last years. I hope these new ideas in this document came out of lack of knowledge and were not intended. Thanks. It was maximal today.
Thank you, Tim Switzer. Thank you. Thank you, Maxim. So I think, and I guess I'll direct my question to Krista. Well, I think I saw also Christine walk in. So I think the point here is that, you know, part way through the initial evaluations, there had to be some clarifications around the letter of credit requirements. I think I've heard throughout this whole process that some of the letter of credit requirements don't play well when outside U.S. venues. I think the time frame, again, from when we submitted these originally and to when you signed the contract, again, creates a scenario where a new letter of credit has to be obtained. So it's been a challenging, I think, concept. So is there anything, Christine or Krista, that you can comment on this as far as, how this process is working and how it will, continue to kind of work going forward? Thank you.
Thanks, Maxim, and thanks, Tim. This is Krista again. So the process for the COI outreach, is that what you're referring to, how that process is going to work, or did you want me to kind of clarify?
It's Maxim.
We're getting ready to get a response here. So let's go ahead and let them respond. Christine has made her way up to the mic. Thank you.
So good morning, everyone. We certainly acknowledge that in the last 6 months, there's certainly been some churn over the applicant advisories sent out on the letters of credit. It was really due to the evaluation panel's efforts to evaluate the conditionality of letters of credit according to the criteria in the guidebook. And we understand that was likely frustrating to all of you and caused churn for you. We know many applicants had letters of credit reissued, so we certainly acknowledge that, and I want to personally apologize for those efforts. It was very unintentional. In fact, it was well-intentioned, if anything. It was really based on the panel's efforts to most effectively evaluate those letters of credit. So I want to apologize for that. In terms of the criteria for the letters of credit and the evaluation and the changes, as was mentioned, I will let Trang Nguyen address that.
Thanks, Christine. And you know, and to address your question, Maxim, with regards to the 5 years versus 6 years, that's always been in the guidebook. There's been no changes to that. As part of the application process, the requirement of question 50 had always been that the LOC be in place for 5 years, and the contract, as it was written way back when, had always mentioned 6 years. So there's been no changes to that that piece. And I think, Maxim, to answer your other question, which was the differences in some of the LOCs. So I think what you were saying is that two identical LOCs, one scoring 1 point and another scoring 3 points. In reference to what Christine was just saying, the result of the change in removing conditionality from initial evaluation resulted in some of the LOCs that were evaluated later on scoring 3 points, and some of the earlier LOCs scoring 1 point, even though they may be identical LOCs. So that's the reason why. Yes, and what, as communicated previously, what we're going to be doing is we're going to be revising the IRE reports for those applications prior to priority 1100, I believe, to reflect the 3 points for any LOCs that meet the criteria for 3 points without taking into consideration the conditions.
Thank you. Go ahead, Jeff.
Thanks. I thought there was Jeff Newman, sorry. I thought there was a really great question. I can't remember who asked it at the I don't even remember what session it was. I think it was Jim Prendergast who raised the question or comment. At what point can someone assume that if they have not gotten a request to change their letter of credit, that they're in the clear?
Yeah, so it's Krista. We're going to be posting who we've done. Let me try that again. we committed in the contracting session on Monday that we would post through which priority numbers COI outreach has occurred for. So if you are priority number 20 and we've done outreach on priorities 1 through 40 and you didn't get one, that means that your COI, the one that we have on file, was deemed to be sufficient.
Thank you. Next up, Jacob.
Hi, Jacob Malthouse with Big Room. Just a point that maybe of interest to some. One of the challenges we had with looking at the letter of credit was that banks often have very specific commercial language. And so we actually went with an escrow agreement, and we found that the language was a lot more easier and flexible to implement. So if there are people that are having trouble, one of the things that we ended up doing is using that escrow service, and the language was a lot easier to kind of mesh into ICANN's requirements. The other thing that has sort of been rattling around in the back of our minds is that we're hearing that the way that the LOC and that the COI was structured really incented applicants to sort of underestimate their number of registrations that they wanted to achieve after 3 years, even though their internal projections were much higher, so as to reduce the amount that they had to put in place for the COI. You know, it's one of those things where the COI is meant to address security and stability issues, and it may have had, you know, an unintended consequence of actually getting really low estimates out of applicants so that they could keep those COI numbers down, which may end up with more of a restricted pool to address problems that could arise. So in terms of calculating the amounts, I mean, there was a lot of alchemy in terms of how people calculated those amounts, and we felt like the guidance was a little bit Woolley in terms of how you could actually calculate the amounts and tie those to the number of registrations. And just going forward, thinking about future rounds, making sure that you know those, there's not unintended consequences of things like this would potentially be useful. Thanks.
Trang Nguyen. Thanks, Jacob. That's good feedback.
Great. Thank you. We have a question from Maxim that he typed in. It's to Krista, I guess. Is the $300,000 U.S. dollars cap going to be back to the CIR?
Maxim, this is Trang Nguyen again. I believe you're referring to the $300,000 maximum for the COI amount, and I'm not sure how that ties into the CIR, which is a contracting information request. Are you asking how is that tying back to the COI, perhaps?
Yes.
So, per the guidance that I can previously publish, the minimum COI amount is $18,000, and I think the maximum is $300,000, regardless of what your registration number may be at the high end. That hasn't changed from a contracting perspective. The minimums and the maximums are still in place, and during the evaluation process, the evaluators have determined what the correct amount is, and unless the amount is still deficient, we're not going to be flagging that as an issue that you're going to have to address, in amending the COI. But if the amount is still deficient at contracting time, that's something we will flag and we'll identify what the correct amount should be.
Okay. He just, thank you.
Actually states now 3 years of coverage of emergency operations. And it's way more than 300. So,
Maxim, this is Trang again. So there's two different things. There's your estimated cost of operating the five critical registry functions for 3 years, and then there is the COI amount, which is the ICANN's estimated cost of the EBRL amount to operate the five critical registry functions for 3 years. Those are two separate things. Your internal estimated cost may be an amount that you determine, which may be different from what we as ICANN think that the EBRL cost would be to operate your five critical registry functions, and that's primarily based on your domains under management numbers. So the two figures are different. So
yes, I understand this.
Okay, this is Tim Switzer. Let me jump in here. I mean, unless there's, I think, more in the interest of time and the agenda. Maxim, maybe we can get directly back with you on some of these issues and try and work through some of your specific questions. But I think it's best that we probably, unless there are other questions or comments from anybody, why don't we try and move on with the agenda here. So with that, the next thing is a quick update from Liz on the brand registry group's efforts related to the registry agreement.
Thank you, Tim. This will be a very brief update. The brand advocates are working with ICANN staff on the nuances of .brand models and hope to have an addendum rather than a separate agreement, which will concentrate on the omissions of irrelevant areas of .brand models. Brian, do you have anything else that you'd like to add to that, or is that pretty much sum it up?
No, thank you.
Okay, thank you.
This is Tim. I'm sorry. So I was doing something else. Are you finished?
Yes, okay. Thank you.
Sorry.
Yes, thanks, Tim.
All right. We're going to take some liberty with the agenda here because of some other time conflicts and have Adrian come up and give us an update on what's going on with the Domain Name Association. So, Adrian, let me turn it over to you.
Thanks, Tim. Adrian Kinderis, speaking in my capacity now as the, let me get this right, chair of the interim board of the Domain Name Association. I am doing the rounds this week, doing a little bit of outreach around this association. So we thought it would be great to get in front of you, as all hopefully will become registries soon enough, to join the association. Should only be about a five-minute update here. So if we can just get someone to tap through the slides, that would be great. Thank you. We can go to the next slide. Yep, perfect. So we're also doing a session, I should say, later today at 5 o'clock, which will be combined with the work that ICANN have done with the CEOs, the CEO roundtable session, and the work that they've done. And then the Domain Name Association will be doing a public meeting. And the reason I bring that up is because this slide you're seeing now, which you cannot see at all, is some of the work that I worked on as part of that group around defining the industry. And you'll note here that we're calling it the domain name industry. And I'm glad to see that the vernacular is slowly changing away from DNS industry, as we wanted to be very, very specific about the role we form and the parts we play in the value chain. So very briefly, this diagram here, the outer layer is the internet coordination layer where ICANN sits, amongst others, obviously. Then you have the ICT layer, and then a subset of the ICT layer is the domain name industry, made up of registries, registry operators, registry service providers, registrars, and resellers. And so really they're the focus of the domain name industry and therefore the Domain Name Association. Next slide, please. So the Domain Name Association, importantly, is a non-profit global business association that represents the interests of the domain name industry. We felt that with all the work going on around new GTLDs we're being very, very focused on what is in front of us right now, but who is taking care of the helicoptering out and taking care of the industry as a whole? Who is ensuring that domain names remain relevant? With all the work we're doing now and all the time we're investing, if domain names were to go away, that would be bad. So we wanted to ensure that there was a unified front here to progress the interests of the domain name industry. Second bullet point there is important. We have no formal affiliation with ICANN. We are not funded by ICANN, although this has been circulated with ICANN and ICANN staff, and FADI certainly supports it. We are not part of the ICANN group. There may be times going forward where the domain name industry is not aligned with ICANN's intentions, and we may want to speak out about that. So it's important to have separation there. And the last bullet point there as I suggested earlier, the members of groups, businesses and individuals involved in the provision, support and sale of domain names or part of the value chain. Thanks. Next slide. So what's our mission? As I just said, the mission is to promote the interests of the domain name industry by advocating the use, adoption and expansion of domain names as the primary tool for users to navigate the internet. Fairly straightforward, but we imagine that this will be somewhat dynamic as we grow in numbers and membership and we gain a deeper focus. Thank you. Just some more information here and some key messages. We see one of our roles initially is that of education. There is going to be a massive change in the way that we interact with domain names, and I'm talking here about the onset of new GTLDs. And as part of our role, we see as helping educate the market in that, and you'll see some of the activities that we're doing a little later in this slide presentation. Should also take a moment to say that this group is trying to be as inclusive as possible. We don't see any C's or G's. We just see domain names, or CCs and G's. So I've done this presentation to the CCNSO. We are welcoming to country codes, of course. It's all about the domain name industry as a global industry. We can go next slide. Thanks. As I say, because there's going to be a session, I won't go into too much detail here, folks. I'll try and keep things moving due to time. This first bullet point is a good one. The DNA will advocate for and represent the interests of the industry before policymakers and the public, and will inform groups, individuals, and the public at large on key issues. So this is where we may be used as a lobbying vehicle. We don't want to merely hang our hats just on that. That's not the sole purpose of the industry of the industry association. However, there may be times we want to push on government. We've certainly seen other industry associations like the ANA, that have pushed their agenda successfully. So we certainly want to ensure that we have a voice here and can counter some of those. The intent of the DNA is to build trust, exchange ideas, and educate and raise awareness of domain name-related issues. Pretty straightforward. And we're hoping that the resultant efforts will be to build trust in the online environment. Thanks. Next slide. Okay, so our current status. So this really started... you will have heard about the Google Group as it was initially known. It certainly isn't the intention, although credit must be paid to a couple of members of the Google team that rolled up their sleeves and gave this the initial kick to get the momentum started, and we're grateful to them. You'll see that the folks that I'm about to introduce are somewhat mates, and we sort of just bandied together to mobilise this effort. That is not the intention going forward. The intention is to be far more expansive, to welcome any participant of the industry that wants to get involved. However, in order to get the heavy lifting done early, we've dedicated both our time and indeed money in order to get to where we are right now. So just quickly, the members of the interim board, as I said, I've been voted as chair. I imagine that once we move to a solid membership structure and there is an actual voting process, all of those members will stand down and stand for election if they want to, and I imagine that I will be immediately eradicated as chair and put someone a lot more qualified in the position and good-looking. Thanks, Jeff. Just quickly introducing Jeff Eckhouse is here. Rob Hall is not here, but I'm sure he'd be familiar to a lot of you. Staten Hammock, straight over here in a nice shirt. Next slide, please. Not to say your shirt isn't nice, Jeff. Next slide, thank you. Job Lawrence from Google, who's not with us. John Nevitt over here, equally good shirt. Thanks, John. And Elizabeth Sweezy is wearing a shirt, so that's terrific. Thank you, Elizabeth. Now I've backed into a corner here. I wish I hadn't. Thanks. So all these guys, and I must say, a great bunch of guys that are putting in a heap of effort. This is chewing up some of our bandwidth to get work done, and there is a sizable amount of work that's already been done. So I thank all of them for their participation thus far. I should also make note of the secretarial services of Donna Austin as part of my team. She's been terrific. Thanks, Donna. Next slide, please. So what have we done? Well, we're happy to say that the company has officially incorporated as a Delaware non-profit. So immediately all of you are sitting back saying, well, hang on, didn't you just say there's going to be a global organisation and blah, 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 and then you go and just immediately incorporate in Delaware, which is the United States, of course. So there's a couple of reasons for that. First one being the access we had to some pro bono work with lawyers were American lawyers, and Staten and John and, you know, a couple of the other guys. All have backgrounds in American law, so it made sense to leverage that. The second point is that we imagine some of the early contributors financially will be some large American corporates. I don't want to, you know, hold them to any obligation, but I expect Google will be the biggest contributor. No, I'm looking at Sarah, thanks. In order for them, there is some tax advantage for them if we're located in the US as a non-profit, so we wanted to make sure that we could, you know, get that initial funding the most easy way possible. So that's the reason why. But it's certainly, and those of you that have heard me today and hear me continually, I'm an advocate for an international internet, and I will certainly, in my role as chair, be pushing very hard that we try and get as quickly as possible a global feel to the organisation. So the charter and initial bylaws have been adopted and membership structure is currently in development. Coming out of that membership structure will, of course, be a budget. We'll need to understand what the fee structure will be as we establish the membership. And we're beginning a membership drive, which is why I'm out here taking 10 minutes of your time today as we push to circulate the idea of the Domain Name Association and indeed push for members. Thanks. Next slide. Our education and awareness website has been designed, and I'll show you that in a slide coming up. And we also have our DNA website launched, and that is at thedna.org. It's down the bottom of the slide deck throughout. If you want to take a look, it's really the content of these slides currently, but it will significantly have more content, increased content once we progress. And like all good website, like all good companies, we took a whole lot of time in getting a domain name association logo developed. In fact, we sort of crowdsourced that. Had a whole heap of different options there, which was fantastic. And I think the one we've got works really well. It's probably the colour of the slide deck that's not helping it look as good here. But and I should point out also the A, which looks like an arrow, that's called a cursor. And in fact, we did pass a resolution about the name of it. Thanks. Next slide. Guys, I won't spend too much time on the benefits here. I'll push that out to the major session that we're having this afternoon at 5 o'clock. Donna, if in the meantime, if you could tell me where that session is, just so I can remind people at the end of this, that'd be great. Give me a heads up. We're clearly pushing and developing the benefits as we go. But really, this is about having a voice here and ensuring that we're able to represent the interests of the industry through our membership. Thanks. Next slide. We can go to the next slide. And next slide. Thank you. All right, so the educational website. Once again, kudos to the Google team. This website's fantastic. I think it's going up tomorrow. Is it up now? It's already up right now. Okay, so if you go to whatdomain.org, you'll see this website. I don't know whether we launched with the languages, but if not, they'll be coming shortly. So what we're doing is having this entire website translated into six languages immediately or as quickly as we possibly can, once again picking up that international theme. The website's great. So what the website's intention is to try to simplify some of that language that we all, as boffins here, understand. But those outside here, if you've ever had the experience of trying to explain this to your mum and dad or someone at a bar, it's pretty tough. So the website does a really good job in breaking down what a domain name is and indeed what our industry does. And it once again highlights both CCs and Gs, but certainly spend some time educating folks on the new world that is upon us with respect to the new generic top-level domain name program. Next slide. So what are our next steps? Well, as I said earlier, we're looking to finalise our budget, understand what our operating expenses will be. I should say we have sought and secured the expertise of a company called Virtual, who do this for a living, set up associations. They understand what's required, and they're working very, very closely with us. So we're very, very happy with that. We're finalising our membership structure, and as I said earlier, we will be transitioning to a formal board. We're going to commence our awareness and education campaign. The website that I just spoke of will be a pillar of that. We're looking to do an official launch of the Domain Name Association and start in earnest our membership drive once we can sign on. At the moment, it's just about expressions of interest. And of course, launch that educational website in a more formal way. Next slide. That is all I have. I'm happy to take questions, Tim, if we have time. And that session was in Hall 1B at 5 o'clock today. 1B, just to hear that exact same thing. I'll try and do some different gags and make it a little bit more interesting. But that's and Elizabeth is going to wear a shirt. Thanks, Elizabeth. Any questions?
Thanks, Adrian. I'll just add that for those of you that were there, this concept was kicked off back in January at the regional ICANN meeting in Amsterdam. And there was a lot of interest there. And between now and this point, I mean, there were working groups formed, and a lot of work has been done to get this. I mean, it's easy to say, yes, let's form an association. But to get all the details done, kudos to the team and the interim board for getting this where it is today. Any questions for Adrian or any other members of the team? Go ahead, Adrian.
Sorry, I've got a question for myself. I should really plug, go to thedna.org. You can put yourself down there and just join the mailing list. We'll keep you abreast of where we're at with our membership structure and everything else. If you want to have some input into what that membership structure should look like, by all means, step forward. The interim board isn't set. We'll take new board members if indeed you want to step up and have some involvement. And I should say, for example, GoDaddy more recently have shown an interest to want to join the board. So yeah, we're getting broader and we're happy to keep everybody in tune with what we're up to. Thanks, Tim. Appreciate the time, everybody.
Thanks, Adrian. Very helpful. Any other questions on that? Okay. We're about halfway through time-wise, so we still do have quite a few things to cover. So, Jeff, let's talk about Trademark Clearinghouse. I know that right after this meeting, we've got a two-hour session on the Trademark Clearinghouse where I'm sure we'll have a chance to drill down in more detail. But why don't you provide just a quick update on kind of the key issues and where we're at, and then we'll go from there. Thank you.
Sure. There's a few topics that have come up this week. A couple of those won't be addressed at the next session. And they involve things around the rights protection mechanism requirements document. That's the kind of operational document that governs the relationship of the registries and the registrars to the trademark clearinghouse. It's not a contractual document necessarily, but more just kind of a operational how the rules work. An initial version was published, I believe, in April, just before the Beijing meeting. And then we being the NTAG and the registry stakeholder group, formed a negotiating team, although I don't really like that word. We're not really negotiating, we're just having discussions. And have had discussions with relevant ICANN staff and the legal team on some of the requirements. And Jordan Buchanan from Google has been doing a lot of the legwork on this, and I think most of you have seen some updates on that. But in essence, some of the outstanding issues that still remain and the ones we're having the most discussions revolve really around the timing of the notice of when you have, of how much notice you have to give in order to start the Sunrise program, and how the notice period interoperates with both the collection of applications during a Sunrise period and the allocation of those names. And we've actually separated those two topics. And I think right now where we stand, it was pretty much, I think Jordan sent it to the full list. I'm getting a little confused as to which lists were sent, which emails. But essentially, the way ICANN is leaning is that they'll allow us to do a 60-day sunrise period instead of a 30-day notice followed by a 30-day sunrise period, although there'll be a couple days where you have to give notice to IBM in order to allow them to prepare. So in essence, it means that you could start collecting applications for the sunrise period a little bit earlier than you thought, but you can't allocate those names until after the first 30 days. I know that sounds a little complicated, and hopefully we'll put out a document that it makes a little bit more sense. There's also one of the other issues is, okay, so now that we've got, you know, how much notice you need to provide, the issue of when notice has to be provided to through the ICANN portal to the public. And this is still kind of an ongoing issue as to, initially ICANN had the position that no, you could not even start, you couldn't even give your notice until the TLD was actually delegated in the route. Of course, for most of us, you know, that are going to be putting out marketing documents, and you know, you need more certainty than just waiting for an uncertain, unpredictable time than whenever IANA gets around to delegating your TLD. Although obviously names can't go live until you're delegated, there's no reason why you can't start collecting applications and at a period before that, since the two are actually unrelated. We think that ICANN may settle on a position of being able to give notice at the time that you fill out your ICANN designation template has been submitted. So after you go through pre-delegation testing, you actually then need to fill out a template form for IANA. Once that's deemed to be final and acceptable. It'll be submitted to IANA. IANA will then send it to we'll go through its process. We'll send it to the Department of Commerce. The Department of Commerce will do whatever review it's going to do, if any, and then it'll send it to VeriSign, and then VeriSign will put in the route. So there's all those steps that are kind of in the middle. We're hoping that ICANN will allow that compromise where they'll allow us to give notice starting at the date that the final IANA template was submitted. Another big issue that's been discussed and which is really a big issue that a lot of you have expressed interest in was the notion of the 100 names that you get to reserve and according to spec, help me out here, whatever spec that is right now, where it's the reserve name spec, I think it's in that one. That 5, there you go, thanks. Which allows you to reserve up to 100 names for the promotion of the TLD. That's outside the sunrise period or outside any period. We believe that ICANN will also at least temper, or at least at this point, may accept a notion of those 100 names could be used for things like what some people call pioneer programs or founders programs, where they don't necessarily have to only be used by the registry, but you may be able to delegate those to third parties. Again, this is all still under discussion. I should point back that once this requirements document is actually finished between the discussions between the negotiating team and ICANN, this document will have to go out for a public comment period. I know that's not something that everyone wants to hear, but that document right now, at least what ICANN is telling us, will have to go out for a 21. Well, we're not sure how long the public comment period will be, but generally ICANN public comment periods are a total of 42 days, which means the initial 21-day comment period and a 21-day reply period, which means even if this document comes out on Friday, this document will not be finalized, or the public comment period won't be over until September, which I know creates a lot of consternation, especially for people that want to launch immediately. So I'm sure there'll be some discussion on that point. And finally, the last topic that the negotiating team has been addressing are the issue of exceptions to sunrise, meaning what types of things can you do prior to a sunrise period or prior to or in parallel with a sunrise period, because in the initial requirements document, it said that the very first thing a registry could do was a sunrise period, and that eliminated a lot of things that a number of TLDs had proposed, including, you know, for example, geographic TLDs, which proposed allocating names to public landmarks or city buildings, or you could imagine a whole bunch of geographic designations that have been reserved or intended to be reserved by those types of registries. There's also communities have certain names that they'd like to delegate without going through a sunrise period. The example I give with .NYC, for example, is that there are several trademarks out there for City Hall. And, you know, as I'm sure the operator of .NYC would not want cityhall.nyc to go to anyone other than the actual New York City Hall. And there's countless numbers of examples of that. So we've been going back and forth with the ICANN staff. It's not very – for every time we try to come up with a rule, there's always, a fear of gaming those rules and what operators will do. I think where we've ended up right now is that it is possible for it's possible for ICANN to consider a limited geographic TLD exception for those that have passed the official geographic review by ICANN. So we think that something like that may be acceptable, and that was pointed out in a letter that was submitted by the GOTLDs shortly before we got to Durban, I believe it was. We also had proposed that they would grant an exception for community top-level domains. At this point, ICANN's view is that's too broad to grant a blanket exception to any community top-level domain for anything that they've proposed. We also proposed that they grant a blanket exception for those top-level domains that want to do grandfathering. examples there were things like ICM had proposed or has proposed and put into their application, a program where if you were registered in Triple X, for example, and ICM is able to secure, let's say, the .adult or .sex top-level domains, that they would grandfather the rights of existing domain name holders into those new top-level domains. And the hope was not to go through a sunrise period before doing that to allow trademark owners to get those names, but really to allow the grandfathering rights. At this point, ICANN is not willing to grant that exemption, but there are other ways that we think that the same things could be accomplished. And if you have questions on that, we can go over that after this meeting. So I think the grandfathering will be okay in most circumstances. And then there was an exception that was requested, which I'm still personally pushing for, which is the fact that a number of applications set forth specific launch plans in their application. And if you set forth those specific launch plans and they were subject to comments because they've been out there for 15 months now and you could still comment on them, that those shouldn't have to go through yet another exemption process, which in theory may still have to go out for yet another public comment period before being allowed to be implemented. To me, this just every step of the way is just delay. So a question for the group that we'll need to consider in very short order is, you know, how much do we want to push as a group on this notion of pre-approval of exceptions to or exemptions from the Sunrise process? And, of course, whatever happens out of that, we do need to engage with some of the other constituencies or stakeholder groups like the IPC and others to, you know, see if this is something that they'd be willing to live with. So that's an update on from the negotiating team. There's a few other clearinghouse updates, but maybe we stop there for questions.
Yeah, thanks, Jeff. And just one thing, and maybe this was something else you were going to mention in the other updates, but I know late-breaking news from yesterday afternoon when we had the registry and registrar stakeholder groups get together is that we heard from Deloitte and IBM that the trademark plus 50 scenario is not going to be days or weeks to be developed. It's going to be, quote-unquote, months. And I think they even went so far as to say, like, middle of September was probably the earliest, which, you know, puts the, you know, potential timeline that we heard the other day of early October for a sunrise certainly at risk. So that's a concern. So, all right.
Quick question on that, Tim.
Okay.
John Nevitt. Because those 50 plus only apply to claims and not Sunrise, why would it impact the Sunrise launch?
Yeah, no. Well, I'll just jump to that whole topic, and then I think I'll answer your question. So.
And I've got Jordan in the queue.
Yeah. Okay. So there's a session right after this one from 11 to 1, and more details will be revealed at that point. And I noticed that ICANN last night, or this morning, I guess, in this part of the world, released a document on the trademark plus 50 on some of the rules from the front end of how to get those marks in there. I haven't read it yet, so I'm not sure how much detail it goes into. But John's right that the trademark plus 50 is really a claims activity. And so the concern that we have, John, is that if it's not ready until September, mid to late September, given that there are always lots of bugs and things like that, a start date of a claims period in early October, which was on Christine's schedule, is kind of cutting it very close. In theory, it can be done, but it's cutting it extremely close, especially the point I made at yesterday's session was if you tell trademark owners that you're not going to be ready to accept this trademark plus the plus 50, if you tell them that you're not going to be ready to accept that until September 26th, let's say, and the first claims period starts on October 5th or 6th, you can bet a pretty big outcry from the IP owners that that's not enough time to get all those marks in, validated, and processed in, you know, a week or two's time. So that's the concern we have. We think it's cutting it close, and we're trying to push ICANN and the Deloitte to move that a lot quicker so that trademark owners have at least 30 days or so to get those marks in, and so there's a little pressure taken off. I think that's the concern. An additional thing on the testing, which is a big issue because registries have not been able to test yet with the clearinghouse. There have been some sample files that we can, you know, kind of play around with as registries, and files were released a couple days ago. One set of files, another set of files was released last night. These are good. That's a good development. It's, like I said, giving us things to play around with. A sandbox environment is being opened up this week, we're told, to allow another type of testing. And the what they're saying now, and they'll say at the next meeting, is that a production environment for part of the Sunrise will be released hopefully by July 31st. In our opinion, I don't think that, given everything that needs to be done, I'm skeptical that that'll be out there, but, you know, I'm always happy to be pleasantly surprised. And a full full Sunrise sandbox, they say, won't be available till August 15th, and the production environment not available till August 23rd, which I think could have, again, some implications if you don't have a full kind of production testing environment out until late August. With all the bugs that we've seen in the pre-delegation testing environment, which, again, it's been a good environment, but every system that you have has bugs that need to be tested. It really worries us that early September date could actually be achieved. We're told that testing for claims won't be available until September, which, again, raises some deep concerns about actually having a live environment by October. So there's going to be some more detail between 11 and 1 on the testing, and I encourage everyone to go to that session. There are some other subjects that we can cover after, including the terms and conditions. That's probably the only other topic after this.
Yeah, thanks, Jeff. I think in the interest of time and our other agenda topics that we do want to get to, I'll take a couple of questions and any of their comments, but I do want to try and let's move this process along since we do have the two-hour meeting coming up after this. I've got Jordan and Jim in the queue. Jordan?
Yeah, so I want to highlight a question that Jeff asked before we got into the more operational details, which is, if there are categories of rights that people think need to be included in the RPM agreement as either superior or equivalent to TMCH rights, and you think that they're broad enough and generalizable enough that they should be included as a blanket exception, as opposed to that it's allowed by the RPM requirements, as opposed to something that you specifically request ICANN for your TLD, we need to know that essentially today, because the RPM agreement is really close to baked, I think, other than this set of issues about any exceptions that might exist to TMCH rights. And I think that, I actually think, Tim, that's a really important discussion to have here, because unless we understand which things are common across various applicants, it's hard. We don't want to use the RPM negotiations to try to get one-offs that are only relevant to a specific registry or two of them. But if there's a broad category of things that applies to like all geos or all communities, you know, we're glad to do that work. But it comes at the risk of delaying the RPM requirements document getting finalized, which then needs to be posted for public comment, which if we go along any much longer than about the end of this week, it's going to start to delay the launch of Sunrise for the folks that have already signed contracts.
Thanks, Jordan. Jim?
Yeah. Hi, Jim Prendergast. Just on the trademark clearinghouse and the plus 50 issue that just came out last night, Jeff, one other thing I think we need to nail down next session is we just heard that I think the trademark clearinghouse is now up to 5,000 marks, which is good, but I have a feeling that number will double or triple between now and then. What will be the process that those marks that are already in the trademark clearinghouse have to go through in order to add their plus 50 to those marks that are already in the clearinghouse? And what's their capability to process that in a short period of time? And that's going to be a bandwidth issue for the provider for sure.
Thanks, Jim.
Go ahead, Jeb.
Yeah, I think the document, or at least I'm hoping the document that came out last night addresses that. I think the plus 50 is being considered separate marks, if you will, in the clearinghouse. So you, there's a way in which you would just refer to the marks that have already been approved. The plus 50 really applies only to cases where you could show that there's been a UDRP decision or a court decision on those plus those additional marks. So I'm hoping, although I haven't read the document, that the document that came out last night addresses that issue.
Thanks, Jeff. I've got Jacob and John in the queue. Jacob?
Sure, I'll keep it brief. I just want to say thanks to Jeff and to also to Amadeo Yabril, who worked really hard on this and negotiating it. I think it was nice to really think about these issues and create some space here. One of the points we wanted to raise was that, you know, name selection actually is in the community priority requirements. So name selection is one of the criteria in the community priority evaluation. And our community really interpreted that to include being part of Sunrise, being right at the start, because that's an inherent element of name selection is how names are sort of allocated. So one of the things that we just wanted to point out is that, and that, you know, when we were working in sort of a bottom-up way through our community to figure out how we would allocate names, this was sort of naturally the first thing that people thought. Of course, this is an element of name selection, is how they're allocated, you know, during Sunrise at this early stage. So we don't want to delay things, and we don't want to cause gaming or anything like that, but we do think that there is a space here, and the question is, right, what is the right, you know, path forward for communities? Because that was definitely something that was worked on for actually several years and is included in our application because it seemed to be a requirement in the guidebook. So thanks very much.
Thanks, Jacob. John?
Yeah, one thing we could do, we probably could find some allies in the IP community to push Deloitte and ICANN to get this done quicker. And one way that we may want to argue this is that this is essentially a change in policy, right? We have our application agreement, we have our AGB, and this wasn't in there. So this is kind of like new policy. And just like any new policy that comes up in a year or two or 3 years from now, it'll have to be implemented over time. So we shouldn't hold up rolling out and launching our TLDs based on this new policy. And if it takes them a little longer to get this in, then the first ones will launch without these. And we should encourage the IP folks to push them. If they want to get it in when we launch, we're not changing our launch schedules. They gotta either go faster or they come in a little later. And that's it, because it's just claims. It's not Sunrise.
Thanks, John. That's a good point. Let me, does anybody have any comments or additions to add to the point that that Jordan was making earlier, and input that, you know, again, it being somewhat of a timely request because we need to have the RPM aspect of this, you know, nailed down by the end of this week in order to get that process going through the comment period and so on. And whether that's here today or whether that's, you know, via an email to the group or an email to Jordan or catch Jordan in the hallway or whatever, but that is timely. And so we do need to have any input from folks on that throughout the next probably, you know, 24 hours or so. Any comments to that? Go ahead, Jordan.
Yeah, and I will just say that if there's, you know, if we don't have a sort of a wellspring of support for particular proposals, I think we'll just move ahead. Like ICANN is saying that they will approve exceptions on a TLD by TLD basis. So if you have something that you need for your specific TLD, there will still be a path. It won't be through the dreaded contractual negotiation queue. You'll just submit your exception. I gather from talking with ICANN, and maybe Krista can clarify, you guys are going to change the CIR, I think, what I heard, to allow people to specify RPM exceptions as well, or at least that's what Karen and Dan were telling us. But I'm seeing perplexed faces, so maybe not. But anyways, it sounds like their intent is for a lighter weight process to review exceptions to the RPM requirements, I believe.
Tim, if I may, it sounds like things are changing very quickly, so maybe we just haven't closed the loop internally, but we will do that. Thanks.
Great. Thanks, Christine. All right. We probably need to move along here, and again, I wouldn't
The very last thing that, so we're not even done yet once we do the RPM document. There is still that little issue of a new agreement that needs to be entered into between the registries, the registrars, and ICANN, the terms and conditions, because that has not yet been really addressed or resolved. But yes, there is another agreement that we will need to work through in very quick time frame in order to get that finalized. And I know that everyone's going to need to pay attention over the next few weeks and month to get that finalized, done by your legal teams, so that we can actually move forward.
We have a question in Adobe Connect. This is Josh, by the way. Lucas Valls asks, can somebody clarify, registry operators still have freedom to set any price for Sunrise for Trademark Clearinghouse?
I believe the answer to that is yes. Correct.
There is no price regulation in any of ICANN's agreements on any charges that are any fees that are charged.
Great. Thanks. Okay. Why don't we move along? The next topic is GAC advice, and let me just provide just a real quick update, kind of on what we've learned this week so far. For those of you that may not have been at the, I believe it was Sunday, or it could have been Saturday, I can't remember, GAC and the ICANN board, new TLD program committee meeting. In that meeting, Krista Spain from the board made it, you know, pretty clear to the GAC that in that some of the GAC advice was unclear, it was unimplementable, there was some concerns on their part, so on and so forth. The GAC kind of came back and said, well, give us more clarity around what's not implementable. And basically, my opinion is for an hour and a half, they kind of went back and forth talking about, you know, kind of who owes who what, you know, kind of thing. And at the end of it, I didn't really feel like there was a path forward. And so in our yesterday registry stakeholder meeting with the board, I specifically asked Chris what he felt like coming out of that meeting the next step was, and his comment was that it sounds like it's been agreed that the GAC is going to issue another GAC communique coming out of this meeting, which I assume will be Thursday. I know my concern on that is that when, because it's always better to have the board and the GAC, I think trying to sit down and talk through these things. When it gets into documents going back and forth, it would tend to say that we probably won't have much resolution on this until the Buenos Aires meeting. So that's kind of where we're at currently as far as, you know, and there will probably be continued meetings that the NGPC will have, and I'm sure throughout the rest of this week and when we see the GAC communique, we'll kind of see where things are headed. But I think this GAC advice is kind of here and will be here for the next few months. So let me at this point turn it over to Sarah to talk a little bit more about, you know, kind of what we may want to do and any communication and so on.
Thanks. This is Sarah. So just a few things. One, Tim sent around the language that the RYSG is thinking of sending to the board. I don't think it's been officially approved, but they read it into the record yesterday. For those of the NTAG members that were at the RYSG meeting, you know, the NTAG sort of with decided not to. There were some concerns among some of our members about signing on to it, so we can discuss that if that's something that we want to either send to the board slash GAC or read into the record at any point during the public forum, perhaps. And Tim sent that around, so I don't know if anyone has any questions or wants to talk about that. The other thing that's going on within the NTAG is I'll let TH, she's like not even looking, talk about the letter that you sort of spearheaded along with a few other members in the group, you know, thinking about ways that we can implement the Category 1 and 2 advice. And I don't know if you want to talk about that at all, or we don't have to discuss it. But that was sort of another thing that people were interested in. Pardon?
Has it been posted?
Yes, it's been submitted to the board on June 18th. So a lot of people worked on this letter.
It wasn't an NTAG letter, just to be clear, John, because you have that look on your face. It was just something that a few members in the NTAG group were working on, and just I don't know if anyone saw it, so I just wanted to give an opportunity to talk about the letter.
Yes. So let me just step back and give some context. So Nick.br, Artemis, and a few others helped to draft the letter. The goal of the letter was, some people were interested in not seeing any delays as a result of board and GAC going back and forth. Others, like Artemis, are just really like the GAC advice and want to, you know, provide some guidance to the board to see it adopted. And so the people with these interests came together and drafted a letter, and I'll summarize sort of what it says, but the goal of it is really just to provide guidance on how to read and interpret the GAC advice, the Beijing communique, so that, you know, applicants who are okay with it can continue to proceed. So the structure of it is basically that the scope of it is Category 1 and 2.1, so we don't touch the closed generic issue. And for these two categories of safeguards, we go through first. The first question is, what are the strings that should be implicated by Category 1 and 2.1? And that's the most difficult question, right? And so we try to define tests for the various categories that the GAC lays out. So one of these tests is a user is likely to associate content within the TLD as relating to a sector obligated to comply with sector-specific regulations that are consumer protective. So, for example, .med, .gmbh, or .eco. Right? There's some other tests in there, but just to give more specific guidance as to what should be implicated. And then the second question is, okay, so once you're implicated, what happens to you? And the letter goes through and helps to, you know, determine what happens to you. Actually, let me back up. So who is implicated? There's also a process for either removing names from what's currently on the list or adding names to the list. So the baseline is we presume the GAC list is correct, and then applicants then have the burden of arguing themselves off the list or alternatively, like Artemis has done, arguing themselves on the list. So that just gives a high level of the letter. If anyone has questions, I'm happy to answer.
Great, thank you. One thing I want to clarify is, again, and I mentioned this in my email yesterday, again, the registry stakeholder, as Sarah said, you know, did, for the most part, I think they're endorsing the statement that I sent around, but I know that you know, the NTAG and various, we have a very, you know, again, diverse group, and I think there are different and varying opinions on the feeling toward GAC advice and certain aspects of it or whatever. So, again, we will not, glom onto this, endorse it or whatever, unless, again, we get overwhelming, you know, support, and I want to make sure whether it's today or coming out of this meeting, send in, you know, notes or whatever. But I do want to make sure we hear all opinions here. So I've got Jordan. If anybody else wants to get in the queue, Jeff, go ahead, Jordan.
Thanks, Tim. So one point we discussed in the registry stakeholder group meeting yesterday
was, you know, there were various opinions on, you know, should we just tell the board to, you know, reject the GAC advice, which, you know, we know will take 6 months, but, you know, it may be that that's where they're going to end up anyway, so just tell them to do it now as opposed to negotiate 3 more months and then and then start the six-month clock. Or another alternative is do we say, hey, do we help the board understand a way to implement the advice that's not overly burdensome on applicants and that can get the support of a variety of applicants? So I gather, you know, it sounds like the letter TH is talking about, I think, is intended to take that latter path. I think it would be helpful to sort of get a sense of, you know, can we work together to try to figure out a way for the board to implement the GAC advice to help them in their thinking? Obviously, it's up to the, you know, they're going to do what they do, but you know, we can certainly, you know, I hear like Chris Despain saying in the meetings, like, we don't think this is implementable. If we perhaps gave advice saying, you know, here's a way the applicants view this as being implementable that we would tolerate, you know, that may be useful input for the board. Or it could be that we don't think that's possible to get consensus on a point like that, in which case maybe we should just tell them, you know, do what's right, don't worry about trying to keep this as timely as possible, which is the position that we've had so far. So it would be very interesting. I mean, I think we need to resolve that question soon so we can have a position, or maybe we just don't have a position, which is another point as well.
Thanks, Jordan. Jeff?
Yeah, I want to go into a little bit of background as to why the registry stakeholder group has supported this. And, you know, of course, any applicant is free to agree to voluntarily do whatever it is they want to do, and I don't think they need a letter from the applicants that voluntarily want to do it to actually do it. Maybe if the letter is with respect to your particular applications and to try to see if you could speed that along because you're committing to do it, I think that's fine. The registry stakeholder group took a much broader view of GAC advice and the role that the GAC plays in the ecosystem in which we live in. And we can't afford, as the registry stakeholder group, to just look at the, you know, how do I get in the short term, how do I get my applications approved and moving faster. It's more, like I said, how the GAC relates to the rest of the ecosystem and what is going to be the practical effect going forward. So the basic crux of the registry stakeholder registry stakeholder group statement is more on emphasizing the point that GAC advice needs to be consistent with existing national and international law, and that the GAC should not use ICANN to create new rights or take away existing rights. ICANN should not be used by the GAC as a substitute for international treaty-based organizations like the ITU or the WTO, or to regulate an industry that they don't regulate at home, or prohibit the use of strings that are expressly permitted within their national borders. It's a much bigger concept than the notion of getting a couple of the TLDs that are in Category 1 just through the process faster. Much broader than, well, is what the GAC doing technically in accordance with the applicant guidebook? In essence, that's almost irrelevant. We're going to have to deal with the GAC going forward for years and years and years to come. If we don't take a stand on going up against, or not even going against the GAC, I don't even want to say that. If we don't take a stand to advise the board that the GAC is but one player, an important player in the ecosystem, to listen to advice, and that they still need to go through the multi-stakeholder bottom-up process in order to approve policy, then we've lost the war in the end. And I hate to call it a war, but right now it's getting to that point where, you know, if we don't take a stand now, it's not going to happen. And I completely appreciate the fact that some people in this group want their applications to go forward. But if you don't think ahead, I think it's a big, big problem. And the other last statement I will say is I've read a bunch of things, and I've heard the statements from Alex and some others. And while, and knowing ICANN and ICANN staff and how they, and compliance, you may think you're complying with the GAC categories and the provisions that may be inserted into your agreement now, but when it gets down to enforcement, it may not be as compliant as you think you are. It's my personal opinion, nothing else. Thank you.
Thanks, Jeff. Alex? Anthony, do you want to get in the queue? Is that why you're... Oh, I'm sorry. I just saw you moving up toward the mic. Okay.
Alex Thomas, Artemis Internet. So Jeff was staring straight at me when he implied that we're doing this just for our own economic interest. we have a feeling that there are fun, like they've got a good point on some of the substantive points here. I understand how all of the applicants feel like we're playing Calvin ball, where the rules get changed continuously. I think that was inevitable the first time around. And like I said in the board meeting yesterday, what we think is fair is really unimportant versus us as an industry doing this correctly the first time. If things that are supposed to be very trustworthy, things that imply a level of trust are put out by ICANN and then become SEO spam pages when they're after being delegated, that's going to hurt all of us in the long term. And I think whether or not we're in an arm wrestling match with the GAC, if they're right about something, we feel it's better for us to put forward, okay, yeah, you've got a point. Here's a way. They don't want to get into the weeds. I think we can get into the weeds and come up with ways that compliance can be enforced fairly without delaying the project too much, without putting too much onus on us, and that's a better way to do it than to send the RYSG statement. It was like, we appreciate the GAC, but shove it, right? That was, you know, it basically says that they have no ability to change, that the rule was set in AGB, therefore we should not make any substantive changes at all. And if they've got a good point about something, if .med should be better regulated, I think it's a little isolated of us to say it should just, fairness is the only thing we're going to measure. The overall success of the program in the eyes of the world is not as important. So, I mean, we're trying to take a long-term view, too. And I understand, like, you don't want to empower them, and we're relative newcomers. You guys have been fighting this battle with them for decades. But, you know, if they've got a reasonably good point, then just because we don't like the GACs overriding the multi-stakeholder group doesn't mean we shouldn't think about it.
Thanks, Alex. Sarah and Jeff.
Go ahead, Sarah.
Yeah, so I just wanted to recap some of the discussion that we had in the meeting yesterday, which was sort of along what Alex was saying, is that, you know, the GAC has a right, you know, in the guidebook to object to strings and whether or not we sort of agree with the process through which they did it. Some of the ideas that came out was that it might make more sense to try to help figure out a way to implement some of the advice and give concrete recommendations versus just saying that the advice doesn't, that they don't really, that they're not allowed to give certain kinds of advice. I think we can agree that some of it is problematic to implement, and we have to figure out a way to balance a lot of these equities. But a lot of the discussion in from the NTAG members in that meeting was more along how can we give sort of specific advice on either what we really don't like and specifically what it is, or sort of how we can help implement some of the stuff that we can agree on that is within the GAC's purview.
Thanks, Sarah. Jeff?
Yeah, let me just emphasize, and Sarah's right, that's what some of the NTAG members, there were other NTAG members that had a different view. Let me just again point out that the important part of this statement is that the GAC advice needs to be consistent with existing national and international law. Regardless of, you know, again, as applicants, you can agree to do whatever you want to do, but there are certain advice that they've given, including with respect to geographic names, and I know you're not thinking about that right now because you're thinking about the Category 1, but there's certain advice that is inconsistent with existing national and international law. And just so you know, there's a lot of discussions taking place in the GAC, and you know, while you may not think it's an issue now, it will be an issue later, about blocking the geographic designations at the second level. So, and not just the ones that we have to block in the applicant guidebook. There are things like SALE, S-A-L-E, which happens to be pronounced in other ways in other languages that happen to correspond to a geographic territory. That was brought up as one that second-level names that should be blocked, that should now go into the agreement. They also talked about names of rivers, names of oceans, names of smaller towns. And this is just the beginning of the empowerment. At some point, there needs to be a message that the board needs to not just accept the advice, but also consider the role in the ecosystem. And if something is inconsistent with national or international law, that the board has a right to step in and say, wait a minute, we have a fiduciary duty as a corporation to act in conformance with that. And so that's another point. I know it's gotten lost in the whole Category 1 discussion, but the registry stakeholder group, that was important to them as well.
Thanks, Jeff. I've got Brian and Anthony McHugh. Brian?
Thank you.
And Jordan, too? Okay.
For those of you who don't know, I'm with a company called Validaeus, and we supported 20 global brands in 120 applications. And these are businesses who are new to ICANN, and I really want to encourage NTAG members to think carefully about what Jeff has said and what the Registry Stakeholder Group has put forward as a comment. I think we need to think really long and hard about the potential ramifications of what's going on. And yes, there is a specific issue in play, but I want to read to you a few excerpts from statements that were made by GAC members yesterday in coming to a position on a particular string. The previous list is not an exhaustive one. In the future, maybe you can have .Sahara, .Sale, .Nile, .Danube. The list is incomplete. We know some cases where the city name, the state name, the province name has been subject of solicitation of an application. And so again, just to agree with Jeff, I think we really need to be careful about the potential ramifications where governments are, through ICANN, potentially creating new law that potentially violates other international legal arrangements.
Thank you, Brian. Anthony?
I'd just like to echo what Brian said and note that we'll probably be seeing other constituencies come around to this point of view. I think the IPC had a little wake-up call about seeing the GAC as their inevitable ally in things when two large brands were just knocked off the list because they happened to have the same name as a geographical designation.
Thanks, Anthony. Jordan?
Yeah, I mean, I just want to maybe add a slight bit of nuance to the conversation in that it's possible to say that there's portions of the GAC advice that are out of bounds, should be disallowed, and then to say there are other portions that are reasonable. And what I worry a little bit about the way that the statement's framed, and I think it got a lot better. I actually don't have a huge problem with the statement as it's framed right now. But there's a danger that when we talk about the GAC overreaching, we're basically saying, there's no role at all for GAC advice in this process, and everything the GAC said is wrong because there's specific issues. And I totally agree with what Brian's saying, that there definitely seems to be overreach on the geographic side, but it doesn't follow that, therefore, the rest of the advice is automatically invalid as well.
Thanks, Jordan. John?
Yeah, thanks. It's probably clear to everyone in this room that we're not going to get consensus on either the statement or this letter. So considering we have, 6 minutes left and 6 agenda items left, I suggest we move on.
Yep, I agree. Thank you for your input. And we may individually decide as NTAG observers if you want to go on the record and endorse the statement via the Registry Stakeholder Group. You can do that. People always have the ability to send in individual statements and comments, so I think that's probably the best approach. So let's move right along. We need some real quick updates here on some important topics, but Staten, if you can give us a quick update on PICDRP, that'd be great. And this isn't a trivial topic, but unfortunately we just have limited time, so thank you.
Thanks, Tim. Staten Hammock, United TLD. Yeah, it's a very important topic. But in the interest of time, I'll just report that the NTAG did form a working group a month or so ago to work on a proposal back to ICANN to revise the PICDRP process, which is not very friendly right now. So we did that, and then during that time, ICANN released the final version of the registry agreement, which had these mandatory PICs in them. So now this group has developed into more of a, just like Jeff, hesitate to use the word negotiating team, but that's what I'll call it, to push back on ICANN and look at the language and revise it to be something that we could live with. And I will commend ICANN for its receptivity to our concerns that we expressed. We expressed those same concerns to the ICANN board yesterday. And we're hoping we can come to a resolution on the problems in the language. If not this week, then soon after Durban. And I'll just leave it at that. Thanks, Tim.
Thanks, Stanton. Any questions or comments? Actually, go ahead, Krista.
Thanks, Tim. It's Krista from ICANN staff. I just wanted to let you know, Stanton, we got your document last night. We're already talking about it, reviewing it. There's a lot of things going. Today's kind of a pretty full day, but I'm going to try to pool the people that need to be the staff people that need to talk about this. So we're going to try and move this forward as quickly as possible as well.
Great. Thanks, Krista. I appreciate that. And we'd love to have a meeting tomorrow if that's possible. Yeah.
So I don't want to promise anything right now because I haven't talked to everyone. I've only talked to a couple people, and I don't actually know, like, what Cyrus, for example, his schedule is tomorrow morning. My goal would be to do that we could somehow talk amongst ourselves today and then just have a sit-down discussion tomorrow to kind of flesh out initial reactions and ideas. But I don't want to – I can't promise that now, but I'd like to work towards that.
Thanks.
Great, thanks. And thank you to Stanton and the working group. And I would also say I think this is another good example, similar to what happened in Beijing with the registry agreement, where instead of just, you know, sending documents back and forth, we've been able to sit down and engage with ICANN. I think that's a great way to make progress. So I think, again, we don't know the outcome, but it appears like we're working toward an outcome that'll be workable here. So stay tuned on that. Okay, so let me turn to ask Jeff Eckhaus here to just give us a quick update on pre-delegation testing. Again, there was a session the other day, and I think this process has been moved along, but let me just turn it over to Jeff real quick.
Yeah, thanks. Jeff Eckhaus here. So since, you know, a lot of the – I'm not going to get into a lot of the technical details here because a lot of the applicants here have outsourced their back-end registries to others, so I don't think many of you care about some of the technical details, but I'll give you some of the pieces that I think are important here. So the beta programs will be closing up by August 2nd, and for those of you that participated in it, and the way the PDT system is going to work is that you'll receive an appointment. You'll be able to choose an appointment with ICANN through the system, and the important points here that we got, the testing is expected to take approximately 2 weeks. It may require an additional week if there are remediation issues with your pre-delegation test, and the results will be reported 2 weeks after the test completion. So overall, it's looking at about from the beginning of PDT to the end, about 4 weeks. I think there was some – I thought that there will be some compression and some efficiencies as we start moving through, and because a lot of applicants may have had the same back-end provider, so they'll be able to – have some efficiencies there and not go through some of the same testing over and over, but that is not promised, but that is looking for that to happen. I think the other thing I just wanted to update, for those who've been the contact and have dealt with the system, they are updating the communications tool on July 30th, and that should make it a lot better. And for those of you to be in contact with them, they've expanded their hours for when the actual testing begins, and that will be from 0500 to 1900 UTC. And that is all.
Great. Thanks, Jeff. Any questions? Okay. Looking at the rest of the agenda, Craig had said he would pass on an update. I know that Stanton has talked before about the RRA working document. Let me just make a quick comment on the excess funds from application fees. As you know, we've tried to tee this up a couple times to try and address this. It was pretty clear yesterday in the board GAC discussion that Steve Crocker, said there won't be excess funds, which I find somewhat surprising, and that excess funds from the application fees and dollars received from the auction would be, you know, put together, and we'd figure out what would happen with those. So I guess this was on the agenda more for if there was a near-term, let's get this issue teed up. I think the fact that given where the budget process is, given that there's a feeling that there won't be excess funds, I don't feel like this is really a now issue for us to address. So unless there's any questions or thoughts on that, we'll just say that one's kind of like save for another time. So with that, again, we're right at the end of our time. I want to make sure everybody can get to the trademark clearinghouse session. Is there any other business for us to discuss today? Yeah, go ahead, Alex.
Hey, Alex Thomas. I was just going to volunteer. I've been sending a bunch of stuff to the mailing list. It seems that over the last couple of weeks, and especially this week, there's a concerted effort by a powerful commercial constituency to delay the whole program based on safety and stability and security concerns. And I don't think this is an accidental or an organic thing. And I think us speaking as the NTAG in one voice as to we think these concerns are reasonable and here's a ways to address it, but we don't think it should delay the entire program would be very smart and effective. So I'm happy to lead a group to come up with a statement on behalf of the NTAG on that over the next couple of weeks, if that's okay with you and if people want to...
Next couple of days.
Okay, on the flight. Yeah, anybody else who's on Virgin?
Great. Josh, let's make a note of that, and please reply to anybody who would be interested. Reg has raised your hand.
I'll send an email kind of with an outline that people can respond to me.
Okay, great. All right, anything else? All right, well, thank you very much for your time, your attention, and your comments and input today, and have a good rest of your Wednesday. Thank you.